Welcome to the MS edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the multiple sclerosis community.
Hello, this is Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor. We're talking today with Dr. Anthony Feinstein, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, Canada. Dr. Feinstein also directs the neuropsychiatry program at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, a university-affiliated hospital also in Toronto. Dr. Feinstein, originally from South Africa, has just published a book, Mind, Mood, and Memory, The Neurobehavioral Consequences of Multiple Sclerosis. For the past 30 years, he's also run an MS Behavior Research Service at his university. We spoke to Dr. Feinstein recently from Johannesburg. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Please, let's start by having you talk about multiple sclerosis and the psychological basis of the disease, which we often don't hear about.
MS is a very common cause of neurological disability in young and middle-aged adults. There can be some extensive psychological or behavioral changes linked to the disease. You can divide them into two broad categories. The first will be disorders of cognition, the intellect, so problems with processing speed, memory, executive functioning, for example. And then the other big category will be changes in mood, for example, depression, disorders of anxiety, and some rarer syndromes, such as pseudobulbar affect, in which the individual has difficulty controlling the outward display of emotion. These array of problems are very common. For example, cognitive difficulties can affect anywhere between 40 to 80 or 90% of people with multiple sclerosis, depending on the disease course. Depression will affect one in two individuals with multiple sclerosis over the course of their lifetime. Symptoms of anxiety may be even more frequent. So when you run a behavioral service linked to an MS clinic, you are very busy.
Why is this aspect of MS so often overlooked?
You know, I think MS has always been regarded as predominantly a neurological condition. Things actually started to change around the time I completed my PhD, which was in the early 1990s. A few years before that, MRI came on board as a very powerful investigative tool in medicine. And MRI really transformed the study of multiple sclerosis because suddenly you had this very powerful window into the brain. Prior to that, you'd had CT scan, but a CAT scan is not particularly sensitive in visualizing the lesions associated with multiple sclerosis. MRI, on the other hand, is extremely sensitive in revealing these lesions. And suddenly, researchers and clinicians had this new investigative tool that opened up the brain for further inquiry. Mm-hmm. And that was the catalyst for behavioral scientists to have a look at this disorder and say, well, hold on, we can see these large plaques, we can see evidence of atrophy or brain shrinkage. Surely this must come with behavioral consequences. And that started a whole new line of research looking at neuropsychiatry of multiple sclerosis. Up until then, there'd been a few papers, sporadic papers published in journals, but there hadn't been a concentrated, concerted research effort to define cognitive disorders or disorders of mood and affect. And so from the 1990s, the field really took off. Now there's a fairly large literature devoted to this theme, but there's still a lot of education to be done. Neurologists still need to be educated about the behavioral consequences of MS, but I'm pleased to report that this is gaining traction. I mean, the profession now recognizes that changes in cognition and mood are very important. They're in many ways, some of the most important symptoms linked to multiple sclerosis.
Well, you started talking about MRIs. What exactly does a brain MRI tell us about this severe depression that so many MS patients suffer from?
Well, the MRI literature in depression and MS is now very interesting. When I think back to my PhD, we went in search of brain correlates of depression, and we never found any. But that was because the early MRI machines lacked strength. Their field strength was weak. We're now working with machines that are far more powerful, and so you can visualize the brain with much greater clarity. And what my lab has shown, together with other labs, is that brain lesions situated in certain pivotal parts of the brain, the limbic brain, parts of the frontal lobe, the medial frontal lobe, parts of the temporal lobe, the anterior temporal lobe, medial temporal lobe. When you've got a significant lesion burden in these parts of the brain, then it leaves certain individuals vulnerable to the development of depression. Other research groups have focused down on the hippocampus in particular and shown that shrinkage of a hippocampus in a particular region within the hippocampus, the dentate gyrus, for example, is associated with depression as well. So we now have some good MRI correlates of depression in people with MS. What my lab went and did thereafter was to delve further into brain pathology, and we used a particular kind of MRI called diffusion tensor imaging, a particular scanning sequence, in which you can actually extract data from what appears to be normal appearing brain tissue. What my lab has subsequently done was to look at the brain in greater detail. We were able to use a particular MRI scanning technique called diffusion tensor imaging, DTI, and this gives you information on what appears to be normal appearing brain tissue. And what my lab showed was that people with MS who were depressed indeed had diffusion tensor imaging abnormalities in the limbic parts of the brain, frontal parts, medial frontal parts of the brain, anterior temporal parts, and this too was linked to depression. So we now have some good MRI correlates of depression in people with multiple sclerosis. MRI by itself cannot explain the full picture, but it does give us clues as to why certain individuals become depressed.
So it's not just simply from a layman point of view or a non-scientist might think that, well, because a patient has MS, he or she, they can't do what they used to be able to do, and they might be depressed about that. But no, you're saying there is an actual clinical reason for depression.
Well, you know, your point is a very good one. I mean, there are going to be psychosocial reasons why people become depressed. You know, this is a tough disease to live with. It's tough to have this disability. It might stop you working. It can stop you doing all sorts of activities. But we now have some good neuroscience tools, for example, MRI, that can also explain the origins of depression. And if you've got a heavy lesion burden in parts of the brain, the limbic brain, such as the orbitofrontal cortex or the ventromedial cortex, or parts of the temporal lobe, the medial temporal lobe, this too can explain in some individuals why they've become depressed.
Let's talk about what can be done with MS patients who suffer from depression. You mentioned psychotherapy. Can you talk about the role of psychotherapy in helping MS patients?
Yeah, so the American Academy of Neurology put out a consensus paper a few years back looking at the treatment data for depression in people with MS. And the conclusions were that a particular kind of psychotherapy, cognitive behavior therapy, was the treatment of choice for people with MS who became depressed. So there's good CBT data to suggest that this kind of psychotherapy can help individuals who are depressed. There's also some literature to suggest that antidepressant medication can be helpful, but the antidepressant literature is a small one, and we know that people with MS may be susceptible to some of the side effects of antidepressant medication. With something like cognitive behavior therapy, there are, of course, no side effects. It's a very effective way of helping people overcome depression.
Right. And since there are different kinds of MS, of course, we have the remitting, relapsing MS, we have the progressive MS. Can you talk a bit about that? How different types of MS patients will respond differently?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. You're right. There are many different kinds of MS. There's the relapsing remitting kind. There's the secondary progressive. There's the primary progressive. There's a little bit of data to suggest that with the more advanced forms of MS, in other words, the progressive kinds of MS, you may find depression occurring more frequently. That said, you know, many people with relapsing remitting MS can become depressed as well. The therapy is going to be the same. So cognitive behavior therapy will follow the same principles irrespective of whether you've got relapsing remitting MS or secondary progressive MS. The therapy appears to be equally effective irrespective of the course that the disease takes.
Mm-hmm. And do you find any significant difference between men and women in treating depression or any other psychiatric problems related to MS? And I ask that because MS does tend to affect women more often.
Yes, and that's a really interesting observation. You're quite right that MS affects, you know, three women for every one man. So it's more common in women. When you look at depression within the general population, we see depression more frequently in women as well. But when you look at the MS literature, in fact, there is no sex difference, that the rates of depression in men and women are similar. And that suggests that we're looking at a brain mechanism causing depression. So that's a really interesting observation, that you do not see depression occurring more frequently in women with MS compared to men. There's a very similar prevalence rate. And that points towards a neural basis for depression that transcends sex.
Interesting. I want to ask how you got the idea for your book, what's behind it, and how is it being received?
Well, the book was only published last week, so it's early days in terms of how it's being received. But as I mentioned to you earlier, I have run a MS behavioral unit for many years, and I've lived this field for a long time. And so I'm very well acquainted with the literature. My research team is publishing a lot. This is something that's very familiar to me. And so I've collected a number of my studies and reviewed my colleagues' studies and brought together a book that focuses on disorders of cognition and disorders of mood. I wrote it in such a way that I would hope it has crossover appeal, so that it would not just be helpful to neurologists or neuropsychiatrists or psychologists, but would also be of interest to people with multiple sclerosis and their families as well. So I think the book has crossover appeal. And the chapters deal with disorders of cognition, processing speed, for example, which is very important in terms of people's intellect. There are chapters devoted to memory, executive functioning. There are a couple of chapters on depression. There's one on psychosis. There's a chapter on pseudobulbar affect, which is really a fascinating phenomenon that you see in people with multiple sclerosis. And so I review the literature. I bring in case reports. I provide a summary of the best treatment data for people. So it's really a collation of a field as it now stands.
Very interesting. And also I wanted to ask, given what the world has gone through with COVID in the last couple of years, there's been quite a bit of isolation, lockdown. I'm wondering if you have seen any severe impact. Has this made it only worse for MS patients?
Yeah, that's such a pertinent question. Clearly, the pandemic has been a very difficult time for people, and the impact on individuals with multiple sclerosis can be considerable. It's been harder for individuals to access clinical care. I've been coordinating a multi-center study over the last few years involving sites in Canada, the United States, England, Italy, Belgium, and Denmark. And we were able to show that early in the pandemic, people with progressive MS were actually coping quite well.
I see that you've written recently, and actually several years ago, a book, Journalists Under Fire, The Psychological Hazards of Covering War. And I'm wondering, a very interesting topic for me personally, how do you go from covering the psychological aspects of wartime battle-hardened journalists to covering multiple sclerosis?
22 years back, I had a patient referred to my clinical service, had a very unusual neurological presentation. Turned out to be a frontline journalist, a war journalist. And in fact, the symptoms that the journalist had were not related to a neurological disease, but were stress-related. Quite a dramatic clinical presentation. And through the one patient, I became very interested in the topic. And since then, I've had a sideline, as it were, looking at frontline journalists and how they cope with war and conflict. But that doesn't have any kind of link to multiple sclerosis work.
Dr. Feinstein, we're running out of time. I appreciate so much you talking to us today. Thank you very much.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.